Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we're going to be talking about journalism, media, inequality, fundamental issues with one of the great journalists in the world, P. Sainath, visiting us from India here in Champaign, Urbana. So please join us today on Media Matters for a discussion of critical issues facing us all.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Propaganda is alive and well in the federal government, and a recent memo from the Justice Department seems to guarantee it'll stay that way. Last year, the Government Accountability Office ruled that video news releases, produced and packaged under contract by government agencies and fed to TV stations with no disclaimer that they're government produced, ran afoul of anti-propaganda laws and recommended the practice stop immediately. Well, the practice hasn't stopped, and on March 11th, the Justice Department released a memo calling propaganda perfectly legal and recommended other agencies ignore the GAO report. At a March 16th news conference, President George W. Bush, who had previously condemned government propaganda activities and called for an independent relationship between the government and press, changed his tune. He now suggests TV stations mislead the public when they air government VNRs without attribution.
These pieces are within the law so long as they're based upon facts, not advocacy. This has been a long-standing practice of the federal government to use these types of videos. The local stations ought to, if there's a deep concern about that, ought to tell their viewers what they're watching.
Presently, the White House has a special PR operation underway attempting to spin the media in its favor on the debate over tampering long-term with Social Security, and as many as 20 different government agencies have produced and disseminated propaganda during the Bush administration's tenure. Independent Vermont Congressman Bernie Sanders says propaganda, coupled with an ongoing congressional crusade against broadcast indecency, is chilling Democratic discourse nationwide.
Today, oh yeah, it's just dirty words, all right, just anti-Howard Stern. Well, what would it be tomorrow? What about somebody who attacks the president? Well, maybe we don't want to hear that indecency as well.
Legislation to ban the production and dissemination of government propaganda has been introduced in the House and Senate now. The bill in the House has about three dozen co-sponsors, while the Senate bill has 14.
You know, government service is not lucrative. It takes a painful toll on you personally and on your family. But at the end of the day, it's still the highest honor and greatest privilege anyone can have.
That's a tearful Michael Powell at his last Federal Communications Commission meeting earlier this month. Powell officially stepped down from his post as FCC chairman on Thursday, March 17th. He'll become a senior fellow at the Aspen Institute. It's a think tank that seems to be a way station for many outgoing FCC chairmen. The two previous to Powell both became Aspen Fellows before heading into the private sector. Powell's immediate predecessor, William Kennard, now manages a telecom venture capital fund for the Carlyle Group. Powell says the one thing he won't miss is the personally political nature of running the FCC.
It saddens me when public officials and bureaucrats are criticized for ulterior motives, none of which I've ever found in a government bureaucrat.
Powell's replacement as chairman is FCC Commissioner Kevin Martin, who was first appointed to the commission in 2001. That leaves at least one vacant Republican seat on the FCC still to fill, although two more vacancies are possible within the next few months. Another former high-ranking FCC official is now the number two executive at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Kenneth Faree resigned as chief of the FCC's Media Bureau, where he was a prime architect of the controversial 2003 media ownership rules revision, during which he called the avalanche of public opposition to the rule changes nothing more than, quote, an exercise in foot stomping. Faree will now be making decisions on how the CPB will spend its $400 million a year budget, decisions with big implications on the maintenance and development of public broadcasting for years to come.
And now, here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact. It's increasingly dangerous to be a journalist these days, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. 56 reporters were confirmed killed on the job around the globe in 2004, the deadliest year in the last decade. Another 17 journalists are counted in the CPJ report, but the links between their deaths and their work are inconclusive. The most dangerous place to cover news was Iraq, where 23 journalists died. The second most dangerous country was the Philippines. Additionally, 122 journalists were jailed for doing their job last year. That's actually a slight decrease from the year before. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you here in mid-March 2005. Today I've got in the studio P. Sinat, one of Asia's leading developmental journalists who writes frequently about issues, poverty, the effect of industrialization, and one of the best-known journalists in all of India. He's won numerous awards for his reporting, including the European Commission's Natali Prize in 1994, and the Burma Journalism Prize?
That's right.
Burma Journalism Prize from the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization in 2001. He is also the first winner of Amnesty International's Global Human Rights Journalism Prize. He's the author of Everybody Loves a Good Drought, Stories from India's Poorest Districts. Thank you so much, P. Sinat, for coming to join us today on Media Matters.
Pleasure.
Well, there's so much to talk about. I should tell our listeners that I first met Sinat 3 or 4 years ago in Madison, Wisconsin, in the offices of the Progressive magazine, and was instantly taken by his analysis. And so when the opportunity came to get him in the studio, again, I jumped on it. This show was recorded when Sinat was in town a few days before we went on air. So please don't try to call in today. Sit back, relax, and let the professional yakkers do the talking for the next 53 minutes. Well, let's get started, Sinat, if we can, with a little bit about your background, because I suspect most of our listeners are probably not very familiar with you or with the state of journalism in India. And the state of politics in India. So a little bit more about your background, if you would, and then we'll talk about why you're in town.
This is my 25th year in the profession of journalism, out of which the last 12 I've spent as a rural reporter, which means I spend about 250 to 270 days a year village-bound. So I've worked in a news agency, in a daily, in a weekly. And after 12 years of freelancing, I'm back with The Hindu, which is a very large newspaper in the south of India. It's circulation of about close to 1 million.
What language is The Hindu published in?
The Hindu is published in English. Mm-hmm. But my work gets picked up in many languages. Mm-hmm. I mean, anything I write automatically appears in Telugu and Malayalam and Tamil because of the kind of issues I'm writing about. The Indian language press is much more plugged into those. Mm-hmm. And so what I do is I live with the communities I write about. So if I'm writing about farmers, which is what I've been doing for several years now, I stay in the farming communities and try to look at the world from, you know, through their eyes and the kind of trauma that's now gripping small farmers everywhere, whether in the United States or in India. The principles are broadly the same.
Now, we've heard, if I can interrupt here, as you're talking about farmers and what's going on in India, one of the few things about India that has crossed over to U.S. consciousness in the past few decades probably has been the notion of the Green Revolution, that there's been this vast increase in the output of food that solved a lot of the hunger problems of South Asia. You know, that's about all we know about agriculture in India to the extent we know anything. How accurate is that
picture?
It is
true that in the immediate aftermath of the Green Revolution, there were huge increases in production.
And this is going back a few decades now?
Yeah, it goes back to the late 60s. Mm-hmm. As of now, India is in the greatest agrarian crisis it has seen since prior to the Green Revolution. Now, what's happened is that though you had these massive increases, one, that model of farming seems to have run its course. More importantly, worldwide in the 90s, as you know, we had the structural adjustment programs brought in by the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the new institutional arrangements of the World Trade Organization. These effectively and embraced by a, let it be said, by a very willing Indian elite, delighted to adopt those measures. That has devastated Indian agriculture. The rates of growth of production, of food production, halved in the 1990s and were growing at a much slower rate than the workforce or the population. And at the same time, the reforms of the structural adjustment kind, the neoliberal economic reforms, meant a major transfer of resources from poor to rich. So at one end of the spectrum, you had people eating better than they ever did in their lives. At the other end of the spectrum, you have chaos.
You know, it's funny you should mention that. Funny is absolutely not the proper word to use in this case, but it's interesting you should mention that because I read the Financial Times regularly. It's a newspaper that one of the best newspapers that covers politics in the world in the English language. And it periodically has articles about the top part of the Indian society and the boom there and the great degree of economic growth. And the impression that it's given to, the, again, in the brief coverage we have of India in the U.S. news media, which is largely in the business press, is of a country that has really sort of found its legs finally after moping around. And now it's in booming economic growth and it is poised to move arm in arm with China to ascendancy to be a great world power and a dominant economic force with much higher standards of living in the next few decades. Is that... I suggest that it seems from what you're saying there's a lot more to the picture than what we're getting.
Let me address that two ways. All those claims that you saw in the Financial Times, in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal are absolutely true if we are talking about 5% of the population, maybe up to 10. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about the bottom 30% or the bottom 50% of the Indian population or the vast majority of the Indian population, then it's pure rubbish. In the period of this where we were painted this dynamic tiger economy, we actually slipped in the United Nations Human Development Index rankings. Where in just a period of 3 to 4 years, we slipped from rank 124, which was bad enough to begin with, to rank 127 in the UNDP's Human Development Index, which ranking means that if you're a poor person seeking a place to live, you would be better off living in Botswana or the occupied territories of Palestine than a poor, poor Indian. Right? So that's the great improvement that's taken place.
Now, of course, the great argument that's given by those at the top and those who like the current situation is that only by letting the rich get vastly richer will you give incentive to the others to either work harder or for those who aren't so crude.
As you know very well, there are few more discredited theories than the trickle-down one.
Well, that, but that's
actually, when you look at something, a magazine like Economist prosing on about this, for instance, it's worth recalling what the founding editor of The Economist, Walter Bagehot, you know, more than 150, 200 years ago, wrote, "It's impossible to make the rich understand hunger because they cannot understand why, if you're hungry, you don't ring the bell and tell the butler what you want." So, yeah, so it's very difficult to explain. The New York Times has written about everybody is going to the mall. You know, the mall culture. You must have seen one of those
stories.
Sure,
that's the upper class of India.
You know what? If everybody in India were going to the mall, Bob, it would have to be one hell of a big mall. Okay? it's a very narrow, but the thing is, just to give you a relative sense, they get impressed by the numbers because 10% of the Indian population is bigger than most European countries.
It's about 50 million people.
It's 100
million people.
So it looks huge. And if your correspondents never venture outside the capital city or within the cities they go to, never venture outside the circle of what I call the beautiful people, then they never go to the kind of rubbish. I mean, I could quote for you from some of the brilliant pieces written in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, all of which went horribly wrong in last year's historic elections when they expected the reforms government to win, and it took the thrashing of its life. The Wall Street Journal, in fact, wrote a very angry outburst against the elections in which it said, "Democracy is perverse."
We're talking to P. Sainath today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This show is coming on a couple days after we taped it. Sainath was in town, and I took advantage of it to get into studio. Synod is one of the leading journalists in the world and certainly one of Asia's leading developmental journalists, winner of numerous prestigious international awards in journalism, including Amnesty International's Global Human Rights Journalism Prize. It is an honor to have you here in the WILL studios today, talking about Indian politics, the nature of inequality in India today. And I'd also, of course, like to talk about journalism and media, both in India and around the world. You know, one of the things about India that gets, again, not a great deal of coverage in American politics is the elections you just mentioned. What is, you know, for decades, India was run by the Congress Party, which sort of dominated politics, much like the pre-dominated Mexican politics, without serious challenge. But it is really, in the past decade or so, Indian politics has really undergone some dramatic changes. Could you sort of explain those and how those relate to the changes in society you're talking about?
Oh, there were four there were four major shifts in the 80s and 90s, which I think were quite progressive. One, I mean, the decline of the Congress Party in that period is also related to those shifts. As a journalist, I find that people today are far more assertive about their rights across the country than they were 25 years ago when I began. I find it in the way they talk to me in the villages. Civility is on the decline, you know, and people question you and want to know who you are and why you're here and what is your interest in being here, which was never the case when I began journalism.
A greater democratic impulse.
That's one. Two, the rulers are not able to rule in the old way. The quasi-unitary state that India really is, we're a federal state in name, but the center has excessive powers, that's been under challenge severely. And there have been the ruling combinations have been unable to run the country in the old way, and people are not willing to be ruled in the old way. Third was the upsurge of the oppressed classes and the oppressed peoples, like the former untouchables, the Dalits, the indigenous peoples, whom we call the Adivasis, or first dwellers. These sections have been in ferment and turmoil in the last two decades and have been challenging the circumstances under which they are forced to live, the way they are displaced for major projects. This was the third major shift. In fact, the country's biggest state, Uttar Pradesh, has seen a Dalit woman as chief minister three times. Now, regardless of whether she's a good chief minister or a bad chief minister, it was unthinkable 20 years ago. So that's the third major shift. The fourth is institutional meltdown. People are refusing to respect the old authority, structures of old authority. And the coming of local village governance was a big step, a constitutional amendment in the early 90s that brought thousands of people into levers of governance at the village level from which they had been previously excluded, except in left-ruled states.
So these are all positive developments, these four.
Yeah, but they're all under serious threat because what happens when village governance meets globalization? Okay, so that the former untouchable woman who is the president of the village has to preside over the agricultural destiny of the village while policy is made in Geneva. Now, here's the paradox. At the very moment that the excluded are coming into the institutions of power, the institutions themselves are losing their power, having ceded sovereignty increasingly to international institutions.
What are some concrete examples of the type of issues where they're losing the power, where Geneva is stepping in with power or some other international body is making decisions that affect Indians that Indians could or should be making?
Oh, there's a very simple one. I mean, if you look at commodity prices, okay, it's not just, you shouldn't look at it only in terms of the WTO or the bank. There's also something called capitalism. There's cartelization at a scale that had never happened before. The multinational corporations have developed links down to the field of producers in many of these countries. When you drink a cup of coffee, 1/20th of what you pay for that coffee goes to the women and men who spend their lives growing it. The rest goes to Sara Lee, Kraft, Nestle, Starbucks. Coffee producers in the southern state of Kerala are committing suicide in large numbers as their prices are destroyed by the rigging and cartelization, which ensures that farm gate prices collapse, but not the global price. In the case of pepper,
so the margin increases for the middle person.
For in the case of pepper, India produces the best pepper in the world. I mean, that's what we were famous for, and that's what the explorers from Europe came looking for.
Sure.
Now the new institutional arrangements allow large-scale import of very poor quality pepper into India, mix it with Indian pepper, re-export it to Europe. It's killing local producers. The highest number of suicides in Kerala farmers are pepper and coffee growers. They're producing the best pepper in the world and committing suicide because their prices have been destroyed by the volatility brought into agricultural prices by the multinationals, the corporations, the new import laws. And when India was isolated after showing the world what big boys we were when we burst 5 nuclear bombs, we wanted to make Bill Clinton come to India and as a bait to get him there to break our isolation. India was the only country in the world, as far as I'm aware, that withdrew quantitative restrictions on imports in agriculture 2 years ahead of the WTO deadline. That killed a lot of our farmers.
We're talking to P. Sinath today, one of Asia's leading developmental journalists here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. You're listening to WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. This is a show we recorded shortly before we went on air, so please don't try to call in. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. We're talking a lot about Indian politics, Indian economics, social conditions in India. Sinath, you're visiting the United States now, joining a photo exhibit of rural life and rural labor, especially women's rural labor across India. What's been taking place in India's poorest districts? And I guess it's a tale on one hand of extraordinary inequality and oppression and exploitation, but also on other hands of increasing empowerment and mobilization too. Is that fair to say?
I would say mobilization. Mm-hmm. However, the mobilization tends to be isolated to different regions and areas. I think the most significant thing, the fastest growing thing in India is not software or information technology. It is inequality. It's grown rapidly. It's grown worldwide.
India started with a comparative advantage there, to quote our economist friends.
Oh, absolutely a comparative advantage there. Yeah. What many people don't understand, to come back to your old point about the boom in agriculture, etc. In 2003, India's per capita food availability, which means the food grain available per Indian, was lower than it was during the Bengal famine of 1942-43.
That's incredible.
Now, on that lower cake, some sections of the people are eating better than they ever did in their lives. Which raises the question, Bob, of what the heck are the bottom 40% eating? Mm-hmm. And the media's role in this, as you, to bring it back to journalism, has been despicable.
In India?
I would say worldwide.
Well, yeah, I would, that's almost a given. But in India, how has it been in India? What is the press role?
I'll give you one example. At the height of our agrarian crisis, when farmers were committing suicide, I did a check on how many full-time national media correspondents were out in the field for at least 1 week. I chose this 1 week reference frame very deliberately. And I found that there were, in a country of 1 billion people, 6 journalists spending a full week in the countryside that I could make out. Maybe there were a couple more. At the same time as this crisis, we had an event in Mumbai called Lakme India Fashion Week. Number of journalists covering the Fashion Week, accredited correspondents, 412. And those were the guys covering it for the whole week as accredited correspondents. Mm-hmm. There were 25 to 50 daily pass-holding journalists every day. Now, that is India's biggest fashion event. And the fashion industry in India will tell you quite clearly that the number of Indians wearing anything approaching designer clothing is less than 0.2% of the population, whereas 62% are dependent on agriculture. But agriculture had 6 correspondents looking at what they declared was a drought, mainly, most of them. Mm-hmm. Whereas 412 correspondents looked out for the Fashion Week. The number of buyers who came internationally for the Fashion Week was 200. So journalists outnumbered buyers by 2-1.
Well, I think you're right. It's a worldwide phenomenon. We have similar horror stories like that in the United States on numerous fronts. India is a democracy, a constitutional democracy, has elected governments. As we know from political theory, you just gave us a number, 60% of the population impoverished, and a large proportion of that 60% doing much worse off relative to the top part of the population than they were 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. One would expect this would translate then into ballot box change in the country and governments which would represent the interests of the majority of the people and challenge the policies that have promoted inequality in India. Has that been the case?
It does. It did. See, if you're a poor person in rural India, about the only property you have is your vote. If you're a landless agricultural laborer, this is one way that you can punish governments. And last May, an electorate of 600 million people annihilated governments. And it's wrong to believe that they only defeated the non-Congress coalition. In many states, Congress governments, which followed essentially the same neoliberal policies, were also annihilated.
Mm-hmm.
So people went out and voted against policies that were destructive to their livelihoods. And that's why you're finding that in the first few months, the Congress government was a little more sober in dealing with agriculture, but I do not believe that is about to last.
And what about the status of Hindu nationalism in India? I mean, what, you have yet to mention it, and it's one of the things I hear about periodically, especially from my friends who are Indian. Has it grown? What role does it play in the society today? How does it compare to other types of religious nationalism? We're familiar in this country clearly with Christian fundamentalism.
Well, it grew enormously in the mid to late 80s. It grew more in the early 90s. My belief is it's been somewhat in decline since then. The word nationalist, though, is a bit funny for a bunch of people who never participated in the national movement or the freedom struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the stream from which the assassin of Mahatma Gandhi came. So, you know, mm-hmm. you assassinate the father of the nation. I don't see how that makes you a nationalist. It's,
yeah.
It's a bit difficult for me to take.
Yeah.
But as worldwide, you know, that fundamentalist temperatures rose, so did it happen in India. And a multiplicity of fundamentalisms. They came to power in a number of states, but very largely through a creative and very clever use of alliances on one hand and the divisions of the opposition on the other hand. To date, they have never won a majority of the vote anywhere. And I doubt if in any state they got the majority of the Hindu vote, for that matter. But it's an extremely aggressive movement. It draws its inspiration from, or movements, they draw their inspiration from Mussolini and his, you know, Mussolini's fascism.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
yeah, Mussolini, yeah.
Yeah. And I was trying to remember, was it brown shirts or black shirts, you know?
Yeah, one was in Italy and one was in Germany.
No, I was trying to remember whether it was brown shirts, yeah. So even you find the basic books of their leaders in the 40s and 50s, full of praise for Hitler and Mussolini. And that's the trend of nationalism in quotes that they represent.
Yeah, I've heard, I had a friend of mine who's married to an Indian economist and now living in the United States and horrified by the Hindu politics there. And I asked him what was going on in India. And his response was, this is 2 years ago, his response was 1938.
I should tell you that one of the leaders of that kind of politics, in fact, probably the most notorious and the worst known, will be in the United States on the 20th of March, Mr. Narendra Modi, Chief Minister of the state of Gujarat,
mm-hmm.
in which you had those horrible, you know, communal riots, sectarian mm-hmm. riots in 2002,
mm-hmm.
in which over 1,000 people were slaughtered from the Muslim minority. He is gracing your fair land for, I think, a few days, beginning March 20th.
Well, that's we'll have good company in this country, believe me. We're talking to Peace Sign Up today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. This is a pre-taped show, Sign Up, in town briefly on a North American tour with an exhibit of photographs about poor women laborers in rural India. An extraordinary show, which regrettably is no longer in town for those of you listening now, but worth inquiring about and looking at online to the extent you can. I mean, the Indian political situation is interesting also because of the antipathy between the Hindu nationalists, extremists, fundamentalists, whatever the term is, and Muslims. And then the United States currently, of course, has declared war on Muslim fundamentalism. And so that's the politics of bedfellows again there. What is the relationship of the government of India and the rulers of India with the government of the United States? And what's going on entirely in this region of the world stretching from India east to Israel? And this is where, you know, currently we're two invasions that we've been involved in the last 3 years.
Just before I come to that, I wanted to point out to you that all the fundamentalisms gained from what I believe is the mother of fundamentalisms today, which you can call market fundamentalism, as the structural adjustment programs took root, as neoliberal economic reforms devastated millions of lives, all the fundamentalisms saw their ranks growing. Mm-hmm. They got millions of new recruits because of the destruction of people's lives. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The relationship between the Indian elite and the United States has never been as cozy as it is just now. And whether that's as true of the previous government and the present government might be just a tad more cautious. They have more experience in foreign policy, the Congress Party.
Hey, can you let me back up for 1 second, just for listeners' sake, who are by no means South Asian scholars.
Sorry.
I mean, the historical pattern from 1947 the 1980s for Indian leadership was not to be seen as closely allied to the United States as, say, the government of Argentina or Costa Rica.
Absolutely.
But rather to try to find some sort of autonomy and balance between the East and the West. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's a very fair assessment. And it also meant, you know, an enlightened policy of bargaining between the two big camps then. All that changes with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc in the early 90s. Since then, you have the process of cozying up and a desperation to be part of the U.S. empire. Indeed, I think one of the remarkable achievements of the Indian people, and I say people because the intellectuals played a horrible role in this, was that they were able to stop India from sending troops to Iraq. There was enormous pressure on us to do so. The government was on the verge of doing so. The national security elite were salivating. I mean, they wanted to go in there. They'd got their helmets on already. But there's a long history to our relations with Iraq. And by the way, the last time Indians died in Iraq, in 1916, 8,000 Indian soldiers died in a single battle fighting for British imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same area known as Kut, where also the American army has had battles.
Mm-hmm.
In 1915-16, the Brits had taken a pasting in World War I at the Battle of Gallipoli. They desperately needed a propaganda victory.
Mm-hmm.
And they ordered a very ragged and out-of-shape 6th Indian Army to go and regime change, the same words, change the regime in Baghdad. The Indian Army was caught between, like all outside armies, managed to unite all the factions of the Iraqis. It was cut off and pincered and cut to ribbons in Kut. 24,000 people died in that battle, out of whom at least 8,000 were Indians. You know, so these are things that are very easily forgotten, but it was the people of India in 2003 who did not allow the ruling government to send troops. The public sentiment was overwhelmingly against getting involved in that adventure, and they could not send troops.
Even with all the reported antipathy towards the Islamic world coming from Hindus, that wasn't sufficient to want people to send troops into Iraq.
No, it wasn't. In fact, you would be surprised that even, say, amongst Hindu fundamentalists, their cadres did not want any part of this war.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them saw it, say, as a white man's war, but they just didn't want to get into it. Mm-hmm. And their leadership was very eager to join because they were in government. They were cozying up to the United States. They still are. I mean, they're still cozying up. They're not in government.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a great degree of popular unhappiness about the war, about its causes, its reasons, and it won't have gone down.
Now, how is the press coverage of the U.S. Invasion and occupation of Iraq been in India especially compared to what you've seen in your travels to the United States and outside of India or outside the United States. If you could make some generalizations, what would they be?
Well, I must tell you that most of the big newspapers in the English language supported the sending of troops to Iraq. And you would also find a dramatic difference between how the same newspapers covered the beginning of the first Bush War and how they covered the second Bush War.
Mm-hmm.
The editorials in early 91 were very critical of the war, though subsequently they shifted as the Soviet Union crumbled. Now they've hitched their wagon to the U.S. caravan. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So they're much more willing to overlook certain things or not, take on the U.S. on certain issues, because in every respect, including journalism, the U.S. is now the model.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you've never seen the English press in India as pro-United States as it is today. I mean, by which I mean, as pro the establishment of the United States.
Yeah. When you're in the United States, what is your sense of our news media in general, and the impression the American people who would consume our conventional news media, newspapers and television and radio, would have of the world based on what they're getting here?
When I'm traveling in the United States is the only time I think kindly of the press at home. Okay, because there is still some spectrum of opinion in India. I mean, there is, even in the worst of Indian newspapers, there's a much wider spectrum of political opinion than I find in the American press. And I'm not talking about the alternative media in the United States, which have very rich and diverse traditions, and which I try keeping mm-hmm. up with.
Yeah,
and there are exceptions everywhere, but the homogenization is simply stunning. Just take this country. I consider the United States in many ways to be the second most diverse nation on earth. Look at the number of races, the number of people from the number of countries that they've come. In the borough of Queens in New York, I believe over 100 languages are spoken,
yeah,
and about
right.
20 of them Indian.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now here's this: at the level of the population, the United States has this astonishing diversity. At the level of media, you have Clear Channel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's a complete disconnect. According to me, whether it's in the United States or in India, and more so in India, in my opinion, in some respects, the fundamental feature of our time is a growing disconnect between mass media and mass reality.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening on the ground with people is very different from what's happening in the media.
At some point, though, there's going to have to be some sort of reconciliation or an accounting between what's happening on the ground and what's happening elsewhere, I would imagine.
I think that's part of the problem of corporations and monopolies, and that will have to be resolved too. Because if you look at the last 20 years, I think a good way of describing the last 20 years is the era of the collapse of restraint on corporate power.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that those monopolies in the media and socially have established that kind of homogeneity that you see in the U.S. media. We are faithfully emulating this model, except that India, being a far more heterogeneous, diverse society, it's difficult to impose such a model so easily. That's why they get so disconnected. In the 2004 elections that I mentioned, every single opinion poll and exit poll got it wrong. All the research agencies, all the channels, newspapers, they didn't know what their audience is.
Are you talking about the Indian or the American elections?
I'm talking about the Indian ones.
Some would say that applies to
America. You had
American.
An election too. But the media didn't know what their people were thinking. And it led to some sobering up for a few months, because ended up looking such idiots
mm-hmm.
when the
mm-hmm.
people went and voted in an entirely different way from what was predicted.
In India, we've talked about neoliberalism, sort of the movement for allowing companies to have more power to do as they please without any interference from unions or governments or regulators of one kind or another. One of the great issues for developing economies, historically, going back to countries like the United States when they were developing countries and industrializing, is how you develop your economy and have your capitalist class remain domestic, have it be local people who own the economy, not have foreigners own all your economy. And this has especially been a difficult problem for countries that were at one time formerly colonies, where they were actually run by foreign powers, imperial powers. In India today, with this economic growth and this top 5% that's doing so wonderfully, as we're told, is the Indian economy the province of wealthy Indians? Is it wealthy Indians in part, but also working with foreign corporations? And what's the role of international capital in the state of India's economy today?
Let me point out that you guys have resolved this problem in Iraq. There's nothing that an Iraqi owns anymore in that country. Okay? Mm-hmm. Have you seen the seed laws and patent laws of Iraq? They're written by American lawyers, mm-hmm. and they're simply stunning. The penetration of international capital into India has grown significantly. There are still strategic sectors from which they're excluded, which they are trying to enter in a scale they would not be allowed to in the United States economy, in telecom and those areas. Mm-hmm. You know, Murdoch had to change his citizenship to do certain things in this country.
Yeah.
None of, you know, but...
maybe he'll become an Indian, too. You never know.
Never know. I thought he was heading for Chinese. I mean,
well, you know, that, his next wife will be Indian.
Yeah. That could be well be the case. So the penetration is serious. It has come in a lot of stuff. Our stock market can be very easily manipulated by half a dozen foreign players.
Mm-hmm.
So the entry of the multinationals in strategic sectors is very real. In banking, for instance, it's had a very major impact, and it's growing. And what's very interesting is that most of the moves forward in this direction happen to the cheering and applause of the Indian press, the major sections, dominant sections of the Indian press. They think, you know, there's always been this thing between the colonies and the metro.
Mm-hmm.
The pupils in the colony are far more serious about the religion than the preachers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If any time in history you can show that the United States actually practiced free trade,
yeah,
that would be something. Okay? But we are practicing it for them, killing our farmers, killing our agriculture, you know, in our adherence to that religion.
We're talking to Synnot today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Synnot's one of the leading journalists in the world, based in Mumbai, in India, and the winner of the Amnesty International Global Human Rights Journalism Prize, the first one ever given, and a number of other awards. It's a great honor to have him here. This is a tape show. We went on air a few days before we went on air when Synnot was visiting Champaign-Urbana with a photo exhibit of poor rural Indian women, working women, that's been traveling around North America to considerable acclaim. We've been talking a lot on this show about the state of Indian politics, India, the world, media in India. One of the interesting intellectual debates, Synnot, that's taken place in the United States since 9/11 is the argument that, well, maybe it's time for the United States to stop pretending to be such a nice guy in the world and pretending to, like, actually care about other countries and just do what Britain did back in the 19th century. Just say, okay, we're running the world. We're taking over here. You guys can't run it. That's the problem with the world. We've let you guys off on your own. And then you come up with guys like Bin Laden. You guys clearly aren't up to the job. And recently, an English historian, British historian, now at Harvard, Niall Ferguson, published a book, I think, called Colossus, something like that, in which he makes the argument
for benevolent imperialism.
That what we need in the world is the United States to do what Britain did, to take over, and he lists primarily countries in Africa that he thinks are the basket cases, but I think there might be a couple of Asian interlopers. And have a benevolent colonialism where the United States actually runs these countries. And that would really solve the great problems. These people still aren't up to the task of governing their own lives. And as you might imagine, I don't know if you've seen the book, but one of the countries he holds up as a classic example of the greatness of colonialism is the British relationship with India. So having you here in our studio, I cannot avoid the chance to ask you to respond to this sort of new line of intellectual argumentation made in the United States in the last few years, and Ferguson's argument specifically concerning India.
I think
India.
Ferguson just wrote the Pentagon White House manual. And as for those guys saying no more nice guy, if nice guys were what they were till now, I'm really frightened about what we will see next. Okay, about the Brits. Do you know that one of the great achievements of getting out of colonialism was that from when they left, India never had a mass famine, even though we had a lower per capita food grain allocation in 2003. In the 150 years of British rule, between 24 and 29 million Indians, and those are very conservative estimates, died of policy-driven famines. That was the gift of the British Empire, amongst many others.
Mike Davis has a book that came out a few years ago.
Late Victorian Holocaust,
precisely about, and he uses the term Holocaust, I think, quite consciously understanding its intent, because he argues, I think, fairly convincingly that it's the only word that can apply to these policy-driven famines.
Exactly. In fact, in the 1760s and 1770s, you have the British governor and viceroy, or whatever he was called at the time, Warren Hastings, writing back to the East India Company, of which he was, you know, part, saying that, you know, 500,000 people have died, but we've nonetheless managed a raise in the rents. Okay? Quite cynically, casually, and even with a self-congratulatory note. That's why the way the colonies looked at the British Empire is very different from the way Mr. Ferguson looks at the colonies. In the colonies, the saying was stood on its head. In the colonies, the saying was, the sun never sets on the British Empire because even God can't trust those bastards in the dark. I suspect that was Irish. But
yeah, it may well have. That sounds like something the Irish would say. Yeah. Well, obviously you don't think Ferguson's argument holds a lot of water.
No, and I'm also saying that, first, it's based on a misrepresentation of what British colonialism did. But there are tremendous similarities. There are tremendous analogies to what's happening in the world now and what the British Empire did. I think that the way, say, Iraq is being carved up by corporations bears some resemblance to the opium wars and the opening up of that process. You see very distinct things about it. Now you've got Halliburton having exclusive rights to import oil into the country, sitting on the second largest reserves of that commodity, at a price, at a cost, which if you compare it to the local price, it's cheaper to drive it in by limo from Kuwait per gallon. Okay, so you do have similarities to what the British Empire is doing indeed. Mm-hmm. But
In Iraq, or in, say, the Islamic part of the world, stretching from Pakistan to the Mediterranean Sea, is the alternative to Halliburton in the United States fundamentalism? What are the politics there? I don't know the answer to this question.
I don't know that anyone knows the answer to that question. But you should look at the last 15, 20 years of U.S. operations in these regions that consciously gave a boost to the very fundamentalist organizations that now are so large and so difficult to contend with. Whether it was UNOCAL and the Taliban in Afghanistan, whether it was the United States government and Osama bin Laden versus the Soviet Union. You know, in every case, you have people subsidizing, you have the West, particularly the United States, subsidizing, even encouraging Islamic fundamentalist groups, which now they feel are the main enemy.
Yeah, we're talking to Synot today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. P. Synot is one of the leading journalists in Asia, winner of numerous awards, including Amnesty International's Global Human Rights Journalism Prize, the first one they issued. He's traveling around North America with a photographic exhibit of poor Indian women laborers and this status of rural poverty and inequality in India today. We're talking about politics around the world, media coverage around the world. It's so unusual for me to have someone of your stature with your background here. If you don't mind, I'm going to take liberties and ask a few more questions about the region, which I think our listeners rarely get entertained. And I don't know how much you follow your surrounding countries, but anything you could say would be greater than mine.
Can I just bring one thing here that ties
do.
All one example of an American corporation
okay.
that ties up many of the processes we're talking about, the displacement of poor people, rip-off, and you'd be surprised to know that while Enron has collapsed the world over and successfully bankrupted the richest Indian state, in India, Enron is a legal and legitimate entity suing the government of India for compensation for electricity it never provided, except at cost that bankrupted the State Electricity Board of Maharashtra in the west of India. You know, while
so Enron's going alive and well in India, is it getting the support of the U.S. government in its claims?
Oh, yeah. The arm twisting came from the U.S. government. In fact, one U.S. ambassador to India joined Enron the day he stepped down from the post of U.S. ambassador. The announcement from Enron of his joining their board came before he had vacated the ambassador's residence. Okay, so the ties are so close. Now, Enron comes to India, bankrupts the richest state, which is Maharashtra, and that has an impact on dozens of social welfare programs of that state, including midday meals for indigenous people's children. And those midday meals were scrapped or cut or mutilated because of the losses foisted on us by Enron. So these are the kind of linkages that you have, as I said, from, you know, giant corporations down to the lowest level. It was also a way, you can see how the Indian elite functioned on this and how the media functioned on it. When Enron came to India, all the newspapers criticized its project. Not only did the newspapers criticize the project, it was such a bad project. The World Bank, for God's sake, said it's a bad project. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine, right? The World Bank opposed the project, saying it's too costly. Then Enron introduces a $20 million educational fund, which finally goes up to about $59 million. Now, $60 million buys a lot of education, Bob. Mm-hmm. This was aimed at policymakers, lawmakers, opinion makers to educate them on Enron's benefits. Mm-hmm. They swiftly got educated as full-page advertisements began appearing in the newspapers from Enron, GE, and Bechtel, the three promoters of the program.
Yeah.
Many of the great intellectuals who had earlier opposed the project overnight found that it wasn't such a bad project after all. And, you know, it was going to give us electricity. And then this huge project was foisted on an unwilling population. Many farmers were displaced from the areas where grounds were taken over for the project. Today, we are paying the costs of a complete failure. And this is the model worldwide, the loot and grab sortie. While you can do it, whether it's Argentina, Brazil, whether it's Bolivia and Bechtel and water, whether it's India and Enron and electricity, I think this is what is going to intensify. You're going to see more of this.
And I think clearly that we're seeing that in the United States, Enron and the California energy situation and example after example. It doesn't stop at the border.
And now they're trying to enter our provident funds, our pension funds, and our insurance sectors. They've already got a foot in.
Yeah, when talking to you, what's always striking is that you invariably return to the status of the great majority of the people in your country, the forgotten, really, in our media system, and that you've done a heroic job of reminding the world about and drawing attention to the situation of the great majority of Indian people who live in the countryside and the conditions they're experiencing. These problems don't end at the Indian border. They extend into Pakistan and Bangladesh and Nepal. And I don't know how much you follow rural situations in those countries, but I mean, I couldn't help but notice recently that there's been tremendous political upheaval in Nepal. And I don't think it's, again, gotten hardly a shred of coverage. Most Americans think of Nepal as someplace you go get stoned at 20,000 feet or something and practice Buddhism. But have you followed the events there to any extent?
To some extent. See, but if you look at India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Nepal, I would say that the situation in agriculture is very similar. All of them have seen what they thought and what they called were agricultural surpluses piling up, which was really the result of a collapse of purchasing power of their peasantry. So at one stage, India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh declared in 2001 that they were sitting on a surplus of 70 million tons of food grain, and the same three countries account for half the world's hungry. Okay? Now, 70 million tons of food grain, you can build two ladders to the moon with it in those bags that we mm-hmm. pack it in. Right. So the purchasing power of all of the poor, especially the peasantry in all these countries, has collapsed. In Nepal, the issues, I disagree, say, with the politics of what the Maoists may be raising. But the issues,
and these are the Maoist insurgents who are poised actually to take power in this country, as I understand it.
But the issues of land, those are very genuine. Those are very real. The king's crackdown, I think he's painted himself into a corner. As you know, the king declared, sort of, the king pulled off a coup, so to speak, and put everybody in jail or under house arrest. Mm-hmm. I think he's put himself into an impossible situation. I don't think those issues can be dealt with by repression. I do not support some of the politics of the insurgency, but I'm saying that the issues of poor people in terms of land reform, access to land, access to basic resources, that's something the Nepali elite has rarely, seldom, if ever, addressed. You know, those issues are still burning.
Yeah. Now, to the extent, as you said earlier, that neoliberalism, this worldwide turn to commercial values and the vast increase in inequality and corruption that companies that everywhere in the world. To the extent that the response of that of desperate people has been fundamentalism of one religion or another, to a large extent. But those fundamentalisms can't offer any solutions really to the problem.
No, they cannot. No, they cannot.
So what next?
And you have a good example of structural adjustment and the rise of fundamentalism in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Okay, it had the same impact as in India in that sense. The U.S. has made such a noise over the madrasas, as you know, the traditional Islamic schools as being the hotbed of terrorist growth. The U.S. State Department survey says that only about 12% of such schools had any such links. But it makes it sound like every such school had mm-hmm, such links. Mm-hmm. However, in the 1980s structural adjustment period, government-funded public education suffered massively. And the only place poor people could go to get their kids literate was to the madrasa, the traditional Islamic school. So there are all these things, as I said, are tied in. As I said, the mother load is market fundamentalism. The destruction of public services and in the peasantry, whether it's Nepal, whether it's India, whether it's Pakistan, you can put it in one phrase: the predatory commercialization of the countryside. When mm-hmm. every value is reduced to exchange value, every interaction between farmers and rural communities has been reduced to money. And the world of these old world of the peasantry has been simply ripped apart.
But is there something emerging that goes beyond fundamentalism among the poor and the oppressed?
Yes.
I mean, you've talked a little bit about the local grassroots organizing. Yes. But is something developing that's going to translate into actually being able to challenge to change the policies at a national level?
Yeah. You know, I will not exaggerate how powerful these movements are, but the impulse for them is very strong. Okay. In the sense that you have an election in Andhra Pradesh, my home state of 80 million people, and the state whose leader was the most popular third world leader in the United States, the beloved of the White House, mm-hmm. Mr. Chandrababu Naidu, who presided over this high-tech state. Mm-hmm. He took the biggest beating in electoral history of that state. Okay, mm-hmm. The elections were fought on the issue of farmers' suicides. Now, you know, I find that more heartening than, say, when I look at your elections and what, you know, how they were fought and what they were decided on. At least that issue was at the top of the agenda. So you do have people responding to it. But you're also, as I said, there were four positive shifts in that region. However, they are up against the most powerful array of forces the world has known. You know, an extraordinary gang up of colonial, international capital and colonialism with the most powerful propaganda system in the world in alliance. And yet it's amazing that people don't give up. They fight for their rights. I'm not pessimistic about that, though I think there will be some very bad moments before things get better.
Well, I can afford very many bad moments. I guess we don't have a choice to some extent. P. Sinath, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters. It's been a great privilege to have you here in the studio. Where do you go when you leave Urbana? What's your next stop?
Trinity College, Hartford, in Connecticut.
In Connecticut, certainly. And then Vijay Prashad there.
Old friend of mine. And I taught for a semester at Trinity in 2002 in spring.
Yeah. I see. And then where to from there?
Then to Johns Hopkins in D.C., the South Asian Studies Center there, then to Boston, and then I'm out.
Back home.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you've had a good trip here in North America.
A very interesting one.
And we've been delighted to have you as our guest.
I found that, farm community people were able to identify who came for some of the talks. They were able to identify with farmers' problems in those countries as well.
Yeah, they sound very similar. Yeah. And again, let's stay in touch. We'd love to have you back on the show the next time you're in town. Thank you again.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I'm Bob McChesney. Thank you for listening to Media Matters. And thanks to Victor Picard, as always, for being a terrific producer. I'll be back in 167 hours. Mm-hmm.
Programming on WILL is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASC-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake and suspension work, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. The phone number for TK Service is 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, becoming partly sunny late, the high in the mid-40s with northwest winds around 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with the low around 30 degrees and northeast winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with the high in the lower 50s and east winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.